Here.
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 Are there changes to the agenda? The next item on the agenda is election of 2020 chair and vice chair. Nominations are open for the chair.
I nominate Janet.
Are there other nominations? If not, we'll close the nominations. All those in favor of Janet, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Vice chair, nominations are open for vice chair.
Remember the people that aren't here, too.
Jeff? Are there other nominations? No, I assume Jeff will accept the vice chair. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Now is the time for comments from the public on items not on the agenda. Are there any public comments? Okay, if not, we'll go on to item six, accept and file summary of actions for the advisory committee meeting of December 5. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, if not, we'll accept the minutes of summary of actions of December 5th. Accept and file a report on daily 8-hour peak ozone concentrations, hourly peak ozone concentrations, and PM 2.5 and PM 10 monitoring data for 2019. Rich?
I'm going to look this map to perhaps play out some of our anomalies.
All right, good afternoon. I'm going to give you a summary of the air monitoring data for 2019. We have six permanent air monitoring stations around the district. One's in San Luis Valley Middle School. That's where we measure PM 2.5 for wintertime smoke from chimneys and fireplaces and wood-burning stoves. We've got ozone and PM 2.5 monitoring in Santa Cruz, Salinas, Carmel Valley, Hollister, and King City. And in Hollister and King City, we also have PM 10. We monitor PM 10 at Hollister and King City. The National Park Service has a permanent station for measuring ozone for regional haze purposes in the Class 1 airshed. Because it's a national park, there's certain visibility requirements. So that is also used for determining attainment status for the national and California standards. And it also happens to be where we measure the highest concentrations historically of ozone. There's three seasonal monitors up in the San Jose Valley to supplement the monitoring we do at the San Jose Valley Middle School. And that's all in support of the Spare the Air program that we have provide information to the community there. When we were looking at days when the concentrations are rising and there's going to be a high pressure system and potentially some exceedances of the PM 2.5 standard. So that's our monitoring network. And I'll show you the data from each of those. This is actually an example of a couple of the air monitoring stations. They're sheds or portable buildings that contain the air monitoring equipment, and they just to protect the equipment as well as maintain a temperature range within the within certain parameters. We also measure have some meteorology instruments there, weather, wind, temperature, and relative humidity. As examples, some of the equipment on the left, you see an ozone monitor. On the right, there's a particle monitor, as well as the in the you can see that's kind of a bit of a spaghetti in the back of the instruments, but that's the sampling ports that go into the instruments that we sample from outside the building. These are the standards that we're required to meet. There's California standards and there's a national standard. California standards tend to be stricter. And you can see that each of the standards has an averaging period, so it's not just a snapshot in time that we're looking at, but we're looking at an average of the concentrations of the pollutants for the region, for each pollutant. So there's differing standards, and so we have differing requirements to meet each of those standards. So we're looking at our regional efforts that we're trying to achieve is being under those limits. So you can see for hourly peak ozone for 2019, we are in attainment for at all stations in the district. There's our daily 8-hour peak ozone. We are in attain. We did not exceed the state standard or any of the standards for the 8-hour ozone for 2019.
So, David, between the 8-hour and the hourly standard, which is used to designate an air basin for monitoring? Both of them?
It's the 8-hour standard.
The 8-hour.
But yeah, generally we have met the 1-hour standard, and now we're just really looking at the 8-hour standard. For PM 2.5, we had a couple of days of exceedances. One was in June at the Salinas Air Monitoring Station. That was due to a wildfire that occurred. It's about a 25-acre wildfire that occurred near the station. And then again, we exceeded at the Boulder Creek Station in December, and that was at one of the seasonal monitors, where we have at the monitoring station at the fire district there, where they have their annual Christmas tree sale, and they, as they trim the trees, they throw them into a little fire pit, and then the smoke went into the monitor. So it's something that happens every year, but we discount that data because it's a local effect. For PM10, we exceeded the state standard in late October, early November. That was, as you can see, it's at both of the stations, which are 50 miles apart. There's also several stations throughout California that had exceeded, and we track that back to a wind event that occurred out in the west, southwest. We were seeing Santa Ana winds that were blowing up from the valley from Bakersfield. And so it was a regional effect, and nothing local that was causing that specifically. Remarkably here, this year, we usually see between May and November, we'll see exceedances of the state standard for PM10 at the King City Station due to dust from agricultural operations. We didn't see that phenomenon at all this year, and we suspect that's due to the 2018-2019 rainy season being pretty back to normal, essentially. Whereas before we were having years of drought.
Actually, we should take credit for that.
Right. That's right. So, or you can see our federal designation for attainment is, our federal designation is attainment for all pollutants. And for the state, we are non-attainment transitional for ozone, which is something that is just switches year to year based on how many exceedances you have of the 8-hour standard. So if we exceed more than 3 days of ozone exceedances beyond the state standard, then we are non-attainment. If we are less than that, we're automatically non-attainment transitional. So this past year, we were non-attainment transitional, even though we still only, we actually had no exceedances. And that's just by operational law. We're still in the non-attainment for PM10 for the state standard due to the PM10 measured at the King City station. So with that, answer any questions?
I just want to note that the PM2.5 exceedances in San Lorenzo are dramatic. I mean, that's impressive. Are we taking credit for that?
Well, interestingly enough, we still get a lot of complaints from residents saying that we're not moving. So even though the data shows we can't be in everybody's neighborhood, so we know there's still a lot of issues with smoke pollution and stuff. You know, the first year we started monitoring, we had 43 violations of the federal standard, next year 11. And we haven't replaced that many stoves. We think it's just meteorology and clearing out quick.
Yeah, that's most likely it. If you get a low-pressure system rolling through every week or so, the concentrations just aren't going to
go up. This actually may be the month where we see problems. Mm-hmm. We don't see any storms.
Right.
We'll take it.
Okay, if there are no other questions, motions in order to accept and file the report. Anyone move to accept? It's been moved and seconded to accept and file a report on the 8-hour keep ozone standard hours, keep ozone concentrations from PM2.5 and PM10 and monitoring data for 2019. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say no. Motion carries. So now receive an oral report on winery.
Thank you, Chair Brennan. So this is an informational item. Because this is probably going to foreshadow some rulemaking that the district may undertake at the desire of the wine industry. In short, the wine industry is asking for us to relax our standards with respect to VOC emissions. Wine creates a lot of VOCs, and you're going to get a presentation from our engineering supervisor, Mary Dorado, on this. She'll go over the emissions from wineries, what they're asking, and what we think that means in terms of compliance and requirements under the law. So without further ado, this is a big issue, and this is actually a presentation that the Board of Directors will be receiving later on this month.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Dorado, and as Richard mentioned, the Board directed staff to look into revising our new source review rule because there are concerns among the Whitmer community that this rule is hindering expansion of their fermentation operations within our district. Therefore, we thought today would be a good opportunity to provide you with winery emissions, air district applicability, and a possible path forward to address their concerns. So today I'm going to talk about wineries in our district, winery emissions, emission control, our permit exemption rule, our new source review rule, and the state's rule revision process, and lastly, the impact of a proposed rule to our sources. So according to the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, there are 192 wine producers and blenders in our jurisdiction. There are 110 in Monterey County, 68 in Santa Cruz, and 15 in San Benito County. Of those 192 facilities, 180 of them do not require permits to operate from our district. That represents 94% of the facilities. We do permit 11 wineries, and we are working with two wineries right now and in the permit application phase. One of those wineries requires a federal Title V permit, and that's because they exceed the federal major threshold of 100 tons per year for volatile organic compounds. As David mentioned, we are in attainment with the federal ambient air quality standards, but we do not meet currently, our status is not in compliance with ozone and PM10. And as many of you are aware, VOC emissions are precursors to both ozone and particulate matter, 10 microns or smaller. So there's a lot of operations that at wineries that require permits. There's boilers, there's engine generator sets, there's diesel fire pumps, and there's wastewater operations. But those operations, you can find them at lots of different industrial sources that we permit. What is unique to wineries is their fermentation and their oak barrel aging storage operations. The fermentation process releases carbon dioxide and ethanol emissions. And the oak barrel aging and storage releases ethanol as it evaporates through the porous wood barrels. And the industry refers that to as the energy share. Now, although oak barrel aging and storage occurs throughout the whole year, the fermentation cycle coincides during the peak ozone season, which is late summer and early fall. Ethanol is a VOC, and therefore it too is an ozone precursor and a PM10 precursor. I included a table of our 11 permitted wineries. In the third column, I included the average daily emissions from fermentation. So if we were to look at our 9 largest facilities, from Constellation down to Jay Lohr, the emissions range from 95 pounds per day of VOCs all the way up to 1,800 pounds per day. The fourth column identifies what each winery is allowed to ferment, and that is listed as a condition on their permit to operate. So for example, Constellation, they are allowed to ferment up to 30 million gallons a year. I also want to give you a snapshot of our 2018 emissions inventory. This is for the stationary sources greater than 10 tons per year of any criteria group. And these are the sources that have to report to the ARB each year. There's 20 facilities on this list, and I've highlighted the 5 that are wineries. If we were to add up all the VOCs from all of the facilities, it's 315 tons per year, and the VOCs just from the wineries alone are 158. So doing the math, that's 50% of the VOC emissions are from the wineries. And again, from this inventory of our greater than 10 tons per year. I also wanted to give you an idea of the size of these facilities. The 3 largest is Constellation, Aaron Gonzalez, Estancia, also known as Franciscan, the Winder, also known as Golden State. And just wanted to highlight that these are not boutique wineries. I'm going to switch gears now to our local rules. Rule 201 dictates which wineries require permits to operate by establishing permit exemptions. If a winery is subject to permit, that requires the permit is then become subject to Rule 207, which establishes permit emission thresholds for emission controls and offsets. The 2 exemptions that we have on our books are wineries are exempt if they were in existence prior to 1997 and your annual production rate is less than 1.25 million gallons a year. Or if it's a new or an existing winery that reconstructed in modifications, and the annual production rate is less than 150,000 gallons. And as I stated earlier, the majority of our wine industry is exempt from permits just based upon the size. It's only those larger sources that are subject to the new source review. I also want to give you, just for comparison, what our neighboring air district exempts. And you're going to see that the exemption thresholds vary drastically across the state. In Santa Barbara, they look at fermentation and aging and bottling, and they accumulate those emissions. And if the facility is less than 1 ton per year of VOC emissions, they're exempt. Being conservative and just saying all the emissions are fermentation, that equates to roughly 320,000 gallons of red wine. San Joaquin exempts facilities if their fermentation rate is less than 47,600 gallons. San Luis Obispo doesn't have a permit exemption, but by policy, they register their wineries, and those wineries pay renewal fees. The area completely exempts all fermentation. However, in 2017, they did commit to conducting a review of fermentation at wineries to see if exemptions can be achieved. Our Rule 207 is pretty much the heart of state discussion. And Rule 207 establishes federal and state emission thresholds for permit review of both best available control technology and offsets. And you can think of offsets as an emission reduction necessary to mitigate an emissions increase from a proposed project in a non-attainment area. So the federal back and offset thresholds, which were established back in 1976, are if a facility's aggregated emissions, which means we look at all of the permits, if their potential permit is greater than or equal to 150 pounds per day, they are subject to back and offset. In that federal rule, though, there is an APCO discretion for exemption, but we would have to find a series of findings. The state back threshold is greater than or equal to 25 pounds per day, but it's a permit unit, so that would be fermentation only. For offset, and this all comes from the Health and Safety Code, it was written in the Health and Safety Code that offsets are required if a facility equals or emits equal to a greater than 25 pounds per year. When we adopted the revisions in 1993, we were looking at the federal thresholds, and they're in units of pounds per day. So to be consistent, the rule changed the units from tons per year to pounds per day to be consistent. So basically, 25 tons per year divided by 365 equates to 137 pounds per day. So this is the area which we could look at to possibly revise to help the winery. I do want to state, though, that there is merit other than just consistency in having a pound per day threshold. And that's because the ambient air quality standards are in 1 hour, 8 hour, and 24 hour standards. However, for seasonal sources, a pound per day limit is much more restrictive than a ton per year because, like fermentation, they're only operating 3 to 4 months out of the year. In 2003, the state passed a bill that prohibits air districts from revising their new source review rule to be not to, it can't be any less stringent than what they were in 2002. However, they did allow for what's called a rule relaxation process. To go through that process, the district board would need to make 4 findings. And those findings are that the revisions cannot impair or impede continued maintenance with the national standards or progress toward achieving the state ambient air quality standards. The revision cannot reduce or exempt facility's obligation to meet best available control technology, and the revisions must be consistent with procedural and environmental justice guidelines. I do want to mention that our district did go through this process in 2006, and we were successful in getting an offset exemption, and that's in our fourth column, where it says less than 10 tons per year. What that means is a facility can exceed 150 pounds per day for the federal. They can exceed 137 pounds for the state, as long as they accept a condition on their permit that says our actual emissions will not exceed 10 tons per year. I really want to emphasize this one point, that we cannot reduce or alleviate the need to apply best available control technology. And there are two systems for fermentation tanks that have been deemed to be achieved in practice and cost-effective in Santa Barbara County. And I'm pleased to announce that the two manufacturers of those units will be here to give presentations at the board on February 19th. So you're all welcome to come if you're interested. But basically, these emission controls would allow the wineries to create their own internal offsets, while at the same time allowing the wine industry to grow while still maintaining and achieving air quality goals. I want to circle back to the table of our list of wineries and go over which wineries would see a benefit if we were able to revise the rules. Looking at our three largest wineries, Constellation, The Wine Group, and Benediction, their facility-wide emissions well exceed 25 tons per year. So they will receive no benefit from this revision. Our two smallest wineries, Conundrum and KVL, don't yet even exceed the 10 ton per year threshold, and they don't exceed 137. So at this point, they don't even need this modification, but it could help them in the future. But we're looking at the six wineries in between, from Del Caro and San Benito all the way down to Gray Roar. And they would see benefits in a different degree. So Del Caro would be able to increase their emissions by 2 tons per year before they were required to supply offsets. And Gray Roar would be able to go up to almost 13 tons a year before they had to supply offsets. I also want to point out in the table, it's the fifth row, the back threshold, but again, all of our nine largest facilities exceed the back threshold. And if they propose an increase in capacity, they would have to put on back on those new tanks. The last thing I want to point out on this table is I did include the 2018 fermentation throughput. And if you compare that to what they're allowed to do, Charlotte is the only one who is even close to their limit. They still had 500,000 gallons to go. So just take the wine group, for example. They're allowed to do 9.5 million, but in 2018, they did 5 million. So based upon that table, what it shows us is that there would be six wineries that would be allowed to increase the VOC emissions by 43.6 tons a year before triggering offsets. That is equivalent to roughly 14 million gallons of red wine or 35 million gallons of white wine. Red wine just has releases more ethanol emissions than white wine.
So, I'm a little confused. The proposed rule would change from daily emissions to annual emissions, and that's what you're talking about in terms of the proposed...
Right. So okay. I added up... I looked at what they're allowed to do now, and so if you recall, Delicato currently is permitted to do 23 tons. This rule would allow them to go up to 25 without having to provide offsets. So a lot of these facilities were in place. And so we had to grandfather in the historical emissions. So none of them have had to provide any offsets to date. So this, now that, let's take a step back. We never had emission factors for OSHA or AGM stores, but those emissions have always been occurring. But now that we have emission factors, and those came into play around 2014, we have to account for those. So those have now been added into facility-wide emissions. So that is why all the facility-wide emissions have all been bumped up over time, over 10. Where before, when we didn't have any emission factors, we couldn't calculate it. But now that we do, we do have to address it.
Question just for, when you're looking at the VOCs per year, and there's 100 and something for Constellation, what would be the aggregate of the non-permitting facilities as compared to Constellation? What's the aggregate VOC per year of the non-permitted facilities? We have 100 and something moderate facilities. And only, those are the only ones that really fell into permit, right?
Correct. We have 11 permitted facilities.
Right. So if you took all the facilities that do not require a permit, what would be the aggregate DOC per year for those side by side with Constellation DOC per year?
Right. We would have to do some research because they're not permitted. We don't have the data. But they do have to report to the Tobacco and Alcohol Tax Control Bureau. So we could probably get a number and calculate that out. But I don't have that off the top of my head because we don't have the data.
I would suspect that, you know, because you're going to be giving another presentation to folks that are elected, that this could open up the door to the fairness of it all. You know, why are these facilities that are permitted have stringent requirements? And this has probably nothing to do with what you're trying to do, but it could open the door. I'm just thinking it could open the door in my brain. But if you're looking at the aggregate, and let's assume that if you added up all the aggregates of non-permitted, it's way higher than the Constellation in the top 30. Is there a certain amount of we're looking facility for facility.
Talking about the cumulative impact.
Yeah, the cumulative. Thank you. My brain isn't working too well today.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the very first slide that said there was 190-something facilities. Yes. I can guarantee you those 190 facilities aren't all the implementation.
Correct.
A lot of those facilities would be tasting rooms and stuff, and the actual fermentation would be happening in a Monterey Wine Country. It would be happening in the chat.
Okay. That wasn't clear.
So, that's what I'm trying to help you out, because it makes it seem like there's a lot more. It's probably only.
So that was the best data I could get. I couldn't get anything from the Ag Commissioners, and that was the only list. But I would say for Monterey, though, according to the Vintners Association, there's 82 fermentation wineries. And on our list, we have like 110. So there's still a substantial amount that are fermentating. But again, a lot of them, I did say, were blenders. And so we don't have a handle on that.
Okay. Well, when you saw that number of wineries in the area,
Yeah, unfortunately,
I
don't have.
For a while, but I could then the industry really. Because I just assumed that all of them were fermenting.
So if I could just add, there's a couple important considerations. Number one, I don't think anybody 20 years ago saw the wine industry turning into what it is now. It's huge. There's a lot of vineyards. Now some are coming out. But the issue was it's grown by an inordinate amount. So it's an industry we never saw coming. So we didn't keep up. The purpose of any change right now would not be, although I'm sure our board could direct us along those lines to capture more permittees, but the idea is to relax our standards to help businesses, however you feel about that. The issue also is, and this is important, that for the past 3 years there has been legislation proposed in California to basically take wineries out of the equation with respect to regulation altogether, and that's wine production. And actually, a couple of years ago, our local, now senator, but then assembly member, actually was the sponsor of legislation and never even contacted the district. So, Annika Vieira. So we were concerned it was an urgency bill, and they said it was a public health and safety issue, that air districts should not regulate winery emissions and require controls because it would be a public health and safety hazard. And we sort of said, tell us why you think that is, because ethanol is a sterilizer, and you would be creating, you could go in down the rabbit hole with respect to what causes wine quality. Now it's a wine quality issue. We're being told by Gallo or the Wine Institute that they cannot have controls because it's going to affect the quality of the wine. And that may or may not, we're not winemakers, we're process engineers. So we'd still need a reason for that to be true. We can find no reason because the systems are pretty separate. So it's actually in the legislature right now. So they are trying to get, and I don't think they're going to be able to deal with the state law because the state does not allow backsliding. They're not interested in going back, and the feds aren't going to change the law. There's also state implementation plans in play that take reduction credits for this these efforts here to reduce the VOCs. So it's a really complex issue. We're trying to work through it and be responsive to the request. We're still waiting for a formal request, but the informal request we've gotten from the wineries is to do away with the daily limit and increase from 10 tons to 25 tons per year before offsets are required. I should also mention that the wine group has bought up most of our any type of emission credits that we had for their own growth. So it is a really complex issue. And then the other question, I'm sure Janet and others may have, what does this mean to air quality attainment status? And the answer there is we do not know, and we probably wouldn't know unless we embarked upon a very robust modeling campaign to take a look at the, basically photochemistry that's involved. And there's also an argument that could be made that ethanol is not as reactive as other volatile organic chemicals, although there's no data to suggest that. That was something that the Wine Institute was peddling pretty hard to us, but we said that's fine. Show us studies that demonstrate that. And to this date, actually, there are some the opposite studies in gasoline addition of ethanol. It actually is causing more severe problems in some communities because the increased emissions associated with ethanol during summer months. So it's a really complex issue. But the point too is that the board has directed us to work with the state to have one of these Senate Bill 288 hearings. And in my understanding, there's only one hearing that's ever taken place since the bill was adopted back in 2003, and that was in 2006 here in Monterey, and it hasn't happened elsewhere ever. So this would be the second in the same district. And the state is not mobilized. They're not really engaged to be able to do this. They're currently assigning us an attorney to look into this issue because we've had our rule under review by the state for the past 3 years. They have not been able to get off the dime to approve or deny it. Right now, that rule, if we were to put in these requirements, we're asking them, should we take the rule back or should we amend it? What should we do? So it's a very complex issue, and we really look forward to your input on this because this may be coming back, as I said earlier, as a rulemaking issue to you.
So I have a recommendation, and you helped clarify it, but a slide showing what the actual proposal is would be helpful. You know, going from daily to annual and going from a 10-ton per year, which is the state, to a 25, which is federal, that would be helpful.
Okay.
And maybe we should let you finish.
Yeah, so the last thing is, we also foresee that this rule change would also help the emerging cannabis and composting industries, we're also up against that 137 pound per day DOT limit. And again, off of taking off of Richard's comments, the reason why I highlighted and put in bold that back, it's not going to alleviate their necessity to install back, is because they're pushing back on that too, and they're one hand in hand. By putting in back, you create your own offset. So I don't necessarily think that putting in something that alleviates them offset is going to solve the problem. They need to be able to realize that they're not going to, they still have to do is put in control on their fermentation activities. So with that, any questions?
And I'll just already, a couple other items. We already have if there's vinegar, which is when wine goes bad, right? We have a vinegar manufacturing facility that actually didn't come to us to see if they should install controls. They installed controls. So I'm not going to get into the discussion whether which one is better, wine or vinegar. It just happens to be that we see that the controls are possible, and this is basically a chiller that captures, distills the ethanol, and you're left with ethanol, which can be used to fortify existing wines, or it can be used to, we have some cannabis operations that are going to be using ethanol to extract the oils so they can sell to those guys, and maybe they can have a nice wine-flavored cannabis. That's definitely a possibility. The other thing is that Santa Barbara has folks that have installed it. They're apparently award-winning wines, although I'm told that Monterey would disagree with the quality of their wines. But the fact is that that's being done, and it's currently being done by Scheid Vineyards. They actually, a varietal cannot have, it can only have a certain amount of alcohol content. And so if it goes beyond that because the fermentation goes too far, they have to back it down by removing the alcohol from the wine. So they already do this. And they have a storage tank on site for ethanol, but they're saying they cannot do this because it will impact the quality of wine. And we're saying we could use in the back determination, we could use those arguments if there was some kind of reason that they think that this would impact the quality. And I was going to say, when the automated pickers came through, a lot of people said that's hand picking, there's a lot higher quality. Or some people said, no, it's going to be better with the new mechanized types. You could get in an argument about whether cork or synthetic cork or screw caps affects the quality wine. And I will tell you that ever since those technologies have been introduced, the debate has not been settled. So the Wine Institute is saying that we want to not be regulated by any air districts. We're going to give UC Davis $1 million to study this issue. And then we're going to come back with a recommendation on whether or not we should be regulated. So this is sort of a line in the sand. I think personally they don't want to be regulated, period. Because this all goes away, the growth issues that people just control. Santa Barbara's study said it was 3 to 4 cents a bottle to control the emissions. So it's truly a conundrum. There's a lot of misinformation that's getting out there. And it's true, while we don't understand winemaking as well as the winemakers themselves, we do understand air quality and process engineering. So we're positioned well to work with them. We'd love to see somebody adopt a technology that would remove VOCs. They could actually profit from that by selling emission credits if they're saving by installing those devices. So it's a really difficult situation right now, but it's a real one that the wine industry is pressing on.
One of my comments is seems to make an equity question. I mean, we regulate other sources at a level that the proposal would be inconsistent with, right?
Well, the proposal would apply to everybody, so everybody would get the benefit of a 25.
Oh, is that right?
That could be what your direction is. But if we're changing the rule, it was meant to change the rule for everybody. So we don't.
That could be a huge increase in VOC emissions.
To camp onto that, have you looked at that? How big this increase?
Well, that's that's where the direction comes, is it something that you want us to look at, because that's going to be a lot of time and effort.
I think Karen hit on the head, it is an equity issue, and for instance, if we did relax the standards for the industry, and it's a general applicability under the law that we would be subject to violating these things, we're showing favor to people from industry. And we also know cannabis emits a lot of VOC, and so what's to say if we did it just for the wineries that they could not, they would come to us and say you did it for them. And then we'd have that for surface coating operations, which spray and have VOCs are released. So, but it does say in state law that 25 tons is the standard for annual emissions. The where we got sort of into a weird area is because of our hearing to relax standards, we actually tighten up the annual emission limit to 20 tons inadvertently. So that's what stuck. And so the industry is now saying you guys are way beyond what the rest of the state is doing to go to, which is not entirely correct either. That's where there's a lot of the misinformation out there. A lot of these districts are different airsheds. They have different air quality problems, so the manager air quality differently. So there's not a one-size-fits-all throughout the state. That's why we have certain types of regulations. But the state's going to get in, and this is... The state has gone on record opposing any attempt by the wine industry to not do that.
So you I was thinking about the bottom line is, barring all the complexity of the issue, I think you need a bottom line, and that is, what is the potential, what's the specific effect what you're proposing now, the potential effect is, if you get into the equity issues, of how it's going to affect, say, ozone. Is it significant in terms of what currently is controlled? Is it bad in a great deal? I mean, that's been drawn up here.
Well, that's where the four findings need to come into play, and we would have to do the work for it.
If the board is interested enough, I'm sure there's going to be some of those that are not going to answer. That's all I'm concerned about. Trying to be helpful.
To be clear, too, there is a savings rate that we're not planning on going away with this. It says if there's an increase of 25 as a result of modification or a facility coming up, it's 25 pounds per day, they still have to do a vacuum to demonstrate the fact of reason.
Per permit unit. So state law is for permit units. Federal law is 150 for the aggregate. So they're looking at different measures, and they're different values. And it's like I could say this.
As you can see in that fourth column, all those facilities already exceed the 25 pounds per day value. That's the state threshold. And they all exceed the 150 for the federal, so there's no way of getting out of best available control technology, which is like
that. Although they would argue otherwise, and they're trying to get out of all regulations from the state and federal. And I should say this too, we've been told this by a number of lawyers that the governor actually owns the lawyers.
But again, I want to highlight, this really should only benefit the seasonal sources, because you still took the 25 ton per year as a basis. It's just we divided it by 365 to spread it out. So it'll definitely help the people who work 5 days a week, because now they can take those emissions and go to 7 days. But it's not necessarily, one day they're going to emit 25 tons. But again, it's really, I think, when that conversion took place, it did hinder the seasonal operations.
So could you address the backsliding issue again, whether or not this would be considered backsliding?
So in 2006 and in today, they would consider going from 137 pounds per day to 25 tons per year as being less stringent. So therefore, we would be backsliding.
Both what they're asking for the removal of daily emission limit and the increase.
Right.
Well, I think we could remove the 10 ton per year because we were just, the 10 ton was put there because we took out the 25. And in 2006, it was the wine industry who we did that for.
So,
well, maybe, if I may add, it may be backsliding, but how significant is that in terms of overall equality?
Well, that's where our studies, but we're not going to do the studies now until we're directed to.
Understood,
but that's what
understood,
we would
but I'm just saying that is the bottom line question. If there's been a backslide, is it going to be deleterious, extremely deleterious, mildly, minimally, to what is currently accepted standard?
And like I said, we can only tell you what it is for those six facilities, but how would that affect the rest of our 2,000 permit holders?
So my question is this. Why are we going through this process if we know the state's going to turn it down?
Well, if we make the findings as we did in 2006, they would approve it. So if we go through those four criteria and show that it's not voluntary for air quality, it doesn't impact environmental justice areas and the other things that don't have a risk of health and then they would probably say yes and give it a blessing. And our to answer your question, sort of, we don't think this is going to be, so our answer to how voluntary is this air quality, we don't think it's going to be a huge spike. We don't think it's going to change our air quality payment status, but we don't know until we've done all the work.
Can anybody give me a number on the percentage of emissions that are part of the permit? Because I think it helps everybody understand how this works. The I think 98 or 99% of the emissions during the fermentation, and that's 2 months a year. Then you're just talking about the evaporation out of the barrel, changing the barrel. And that's got to be pretty insignificant to a wine fermentation.
So it depends, but just and this is just an average answer. Those English shares can do as much as half of the emissions that occur during fermentation.
Yeah, so we have a facility that has 35,000 barrels, and I'm going to say it's like 10 tons a year. So they are not insignificant.
I'm not saying they're not insignificant.
Yeah.
I'm saying that facility, when it's fermenting wine in September and October, the emissions got to be very different than when everything's put in a barrel and closed up.
Correct.
But still, if you look at...
Well, that's kind of why I asked you if you have that number. I don't even know what it is.
We've looked at it. So for a huge facility, those emissions from the storage itself are huge. They're about half of what occurs during the fermentation. But some of those fermentation factors are huge emitters. So half of that still is huge. So
yeah, see, I don't really know the number, but I know if you walk into a winery in the fermentation season, it's a whole lot different feeling than walking through one in January. The very carbon dioxide is, but that's been all everywhere.
Temperature and primarily what's driving it is the amount of storage. So if you have small barrel, it's a small number of barrels, it's not huge. So if you have a big barrel, it's a big barrel.
So again, on this slide, I do show the facility-wide, so that is including the oak barrel aging storage and fermentation and minor amounts of boiler engines. But for the larger facilities that have barrel storage, it's 50%.
What would be 50% for volume? It's not going to change.
Correct, but it is a significant volume, and that's consistent throughout the whole year. And again, if you recall...
Again, though, going on the timeline thing, if it is half, and I'm not going to argue whether it is or not, but I don't know, so half of your emissions are happening in 2 months of the year, and your other half is in the other 7 months. So, and it is, I understand it's in late summer, early fall, that's probably the worst time to have the emissions.
And that's why they're asking us to revise the rule to go to a yearly rather than a daily.
Keep going back to daily year or so, and that's kind of why we're
timeline. No, yeah, we totally get that.
So it seems to me that what would be helpful with decision makers is to estimate the emission increases for all affected sources by the proposed rule. I know that's going to take time, but that information at least gives people an idea of what kind of increase in ozone precursor emissions we're talking about. That's short of doing photochemical modeling, but it's an indicator.
So for a small auto body shop that's limited to 25, you want us to assume they can all do 25 times a year? I think it's a lot of these are the small sources. And so there's a large source. But I don't know if you want us to do that off the floor.
It would be for those sources affected by the proposed rule, and that would be most, just most major sources, right?
That could be anybody.
Well, so there would not, other than these sources, there wouldn't be an emission increase?
So you could think of the aggregate people who, that's a seasonal source, and organic rock would probably support that, because they don't operate 12 months out of the year. But they're limited to a pound per day threshold for, you know, 10 NOx. So for the NOx, this would also apply for NOx also for doing it. So the health and safety code is for VOCs and oxides and nitrogen.
Well, if you don't do that minimal analysis, how in the heck are you ever going to decide whether or not it's going to affect your non-attainment or your non-attainment status?
We are going to do the analysis.
Okay,
we have to
okay.
do that as part of the planning.
Oh, okay.
But we sort of, this is not our proposal to the board for us to do. This is something that we're going to propose to the board to so we're at the stage right now where we can direct it to sit down at the state and talk about what this would mean for the region and all that. We discuss those things. So we're sort of embarking down this road, and we want to get your input, which has been really good so far, on what we need to look for down the road. But what you're talking about, we've done some back-the-envelope stuff, but we have not sat down and put serious pen to paper to come up with emissions that we're just not sure. And the board will be directing us on this too, but maybe just please focus on the board and raise the hands and talk about that. So far, the direction has been to engage the state. I think if you have more questions or comments about the impacts and especially the things that I think that's in the news. Any ideas for that since it's very intense?
I do have a closing remarks. For purposes of today, I think you did a wonderful job of presentation. And for speaking for myself, finally, so just going to try to think of things that come at you from that when you get the presentation you did, but I think the presentation is excellent.
I think the equity issue is an important issue to go forward with, to ensure that we are treating all sources equally. I think the fact that these emissions are occurring during ozone season, if we modeled for it, they would have a greater impact on ozone formation than all the other sources that are emitting emissions on an annual basis. And so that's a really critical thing as well.
Okay, so I think all this goes away if the winery just decided, yeah, we're going to install controls.
a lot of times the winery goes to truck traffic, and you know, you're dealing with our emissions, and you're not dealing with emissions of vehicles. Actually, look at the history of vehicle regulation and some of those kinds of standards. And finally, I'll say that with the new administration is backsliding on motor vehicle emission standards because they've taken away California's right under the major and federal plan to regulate our own emissions and develop our own standards. So that we expect all the modeling that's been done to look at compliance attainment is going to be thrown out the window because the administration is going to have dirtier cars operating. So we're going to need to probably get additional controls from state fire services. So one of the things that we're proposing, and I have to have our legal look into this, what if we looked at a winery that was on the fence, wasn't sure they wanted to put in controls, and we somehow incentivized them? Now, that's paying for compliance, which is a problem. But if we called it a demonstration project to show that the winery is what they did for all involved, that might be another way to go so that we could just get some of these wineries that want to expand if they were to increase production. So that's something we're looking at, too. And we definitely have some senior funds that we could use to incentivize that. But the equity issue comes in and we can do that. So we're trying to think outside the box on this one too, but this is an external force that's asking us, our board, as a body, to basically back off on our regulations. And so any industry can do that, but there are reasons we have rules in the first place, and it's the control of the enterprise.
So you brought up the fact that some sources would benefit by control more than others, but Rich indicated previously that the wine industry is interested in getting rid of BAC. Well, getting rid of BAC is not an equity, that creates an equity issue with all the other sources. So regardless of how you average emissions, BAC has to be there in order to create equity with all the other sources. So at a minimum,
that
has to remain as a requirement.
Well, don't shoot me, and Scott, please forgive me for this, but the Wine Institute or the wine industry's counter to that is that wine is special, and it has a certain place in California history and culture, and that it should not be treated as, say, a rural winery or a service winery.
Well, so does
college. And we do have exemptions and exclusions for certain cars.
In a sense, I think all regulators are now just dealing with their own BAC issues. Because we've always had to deal with the lowest hanging fruit to get anything done at all. Because everything is very complex. And it's all politics and economics and technology involved.
So three of us have kind of dominated this. Do you guys have any?
I do. You've got the top five wineries up there. But you mentioned that both the air basins north and south of us don't regulate them like we do. Are any of theirs in this size range? Have they got any of the big boys?
I would say definitely in the Bay Area, there are some large facilities, and in San Joaquin, there's the Gallo.
I was thinking Paso, San Luis Obispo, they've got 400 odd wineries down there. Do they have any big ones, or are they all little ones?
Yeah, they have some big ones, but we're not sure, maybe even Scott knows. Like Meridian.
There's nothing the size of Gonzales down in Santa Barbara, Constellation down in Santa Barbara, or
It sounds like they're not doing
much. But they have a lot more facilities than Monterey County. We are actually one of the smallest facility-wise for the acreage of grapes that we grow. So we ship a lot of grapes to the San Joaquin, and there's at least 10 wineries in the San Joaquin that make Constellation look small, which is hard to do because it's a huge facility. But you go into the Lodi area, into the Modesto, there's some really big wineries. So they're regulated because of their air problems.
Yeah, she didn't mention those, but she mentioned north and south of us. But they're basically significantly less regulated, but...
Even in Napa and Sonoma, there's not going to be the size of constellation, but the numbers are going to be much easier. You're talking like four times the degree of fermentation facilities in Napa and Sonoma County as well, as there is in Monterey.
In the Bay Area, they are embarking right now at this very moment on really making statistical issues from wineries. We had a very
That's a good geographical question. So when you say the Bay Area, is Napa and Sonoma part of that air district?
Yeah, so that was my thinking, is if our adjacent air districts aren't regulating this and don't want to, you know, where's the justice if we are? I mean, which way should that go? Why are we so, you know? If I had one of these big wineries, I'd say one of the other alternatives is I'll move south of the air district or north of the air district.
And that's what they're daylighting and saying is the problem. But once, for instance, Paso, a lot of boutique wineries, they probably wouldn't be permitted if we moved here. So we're equitable, right? Because we're not permitting the boutique wineries here. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it down there. Up north, they've got oil refineries that are catching on fire and exploding. It has not been a huge, thing that they were looking at, but because of the legislation that's been proposed the last 3 years, they started taking a look at what are these emissions. They talked to Santa Barbara and us, and they're finding out that that's a significant emission source for VOCs, and they're in serious non-attainment of the standard. So each district can decide to do whatever it wants. It doesn't have to be equitable, although there is that legal argument to be made about how equitable is up and down the state. But they've chosen, for whatever reason, not to regulate wineries, but they're now looking at it as a major source of information. So they will be regulating.
So
okay.
What is confusing to me, district subject to the state resource review limit? Does that create some level of equity?
It sort of goes back to the question I was posed earlier about, with the emission from sources we do not permit, and so we really that's one way of getting in. So they, for whatever reason, have not elected to look at the amount of coming out of the line.
On the other hand, if they did, it would be subject to the state's NSR requirement, right? So that creates equity among districts, as long as they're looking at the sources. Do you have a question? Really?
But so Bay Area is looking at that right now. We expect to have a little similar to ours for Santa Barbara.
Any other comments? Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're going to have to go get some wine.
So if you didn't know who was going before the board was going to know.
She will be there, she said.
So, all the shirts coming out?
Yes, and just the okay, so in front of you, you should have a three-page document. I'll just go really quickly through this to update you on what's happening currently at the district. This takes place over, we did not have a meeting in January, but December. First of all, board actions, we did look at longevity of employees, and you'll see I'm on the list there too, along with an inspector and Anna Rohr, and our administrative services manager, Rosa. Actually, both Sean and I have been here 11 years, but just because I started, it's going to be 11 years ago next week. It's pretty amazing. Also, the board adopted a resolution authorizing me to accept funds for wood smoke reduction program that the state is providing to us this year. It's only about $175,000 as compared to almost $500,000 last year. We also just got through our audit, and so we saw the draft audit, and we're passing flying colors, very clean. We also let the board know about the winery issue, and we received some direction at that time. And then the board also, this is a big issue right now, too. As you know, and I've reported in the past, there's only four vehicle manufacturers that have opted to go along with California on their emission standards. And those are Volkswagen, Honda, Ford, Volkswagen, oh, BMW. So the state now is saying that any vehicle manufacturers outside those four, such as Toyota or Chevrolet, which have a lot of EVs, are no longer eligible for the state contracts, and they will not be eligible for the incentive program going forward. So what that effectively does is it reduces the universe of available vehicles, EVs, for incentive programs. So the board is not happy and wants to send a message, although they did not take a formal action at that, but they want to send a message to those manufacturers that are siding with the Trump administration to not have more fuel efficient vehicles. And we could go into the whole waiver thing. Maybe I'll do a presentation. I'm doing a presentation later on this month at a climate summit. And then you guys have actually moved this forward, Rule 441 for boilers, steam generators, process heaters. That board received a presentation on the draft rule, and we'll be taking them for adoption this month. We also had sort of an issue with one of our grants on the 2766 program. I think we've worked that out, and that was reflected in the board extending their contract. And actually, we went further and made it even better than that. Engineering, we're working on records retention here for the district, and we're going to have an electronic management system to make it a lot more easier to find, and records retention will help us down the road with respect to public records access and that sort of thing, too. We held a workshop here at the district for wastewater treatment facilities. There's a lot of them out there. And all have engines, which is really concerning right now with the PSPS. I'm not sure if we gave this body a presentation on that, but that's a real problem with PG&E shutting off during the wildfire season, shutting the power. Everybody's now moving towards really dirty diesel generators. We also had presented at an environmental compliance workshop, and that was mainly asbestos, and one of our staff, Ron and Nipney from Bonner County, was the presenter at that function. This number needs to be updated on the next in planning and air monitoring. Our incentive program is moving along nicely. Well over half the funds have been awarded. So we've got $400,000 available, and I think we have about 200 vehicles that have qualified or been awarded. Also, there's this farmer program, which is funding agricultural replacement measures for emission reduction. And we're getting an additional $1.25 million for replacement tractors and irrigation pumps. That we're going to be funding. We've got a lot of people lined up already for that. We have a new employee, and this is great, Laura Sent. Yes, she works in finances, and that's her last name. And she comes from us from San Juan Bautista, where she was actually the elected city clerk. So she gave that job up to come work here, and we're really happy to have her. Engineering. The wine industry has been taking up an inordinate amount of time. And unfortunately, there's a lot of bad blood out there that the district's out to get the wineries and so forth, and that nothing could be further from the truth. We understand there's market conditions at play there as well. But Yeah, we've been also working on the, what's called the CPR, the criteria on toxic emission reporting regulation of the state, requiring a lot of smaller sources to do emission inventories, and taking the district a lot of time. It will require some rule revisions that you'll probably see down the road. So that's another one where we're getting some money from the state, but not very much to do the work that's necessary. Marina has been a problem for a long time now. We've identified probably five sources of odor, but it's not our responsibility, and I hate to pass the buck, but this is something that really falls under the county and environmental health, regulating at least the landfill odors and some of the agricultural potential odors from ag. We also have some composting operations, which we don't regulate at this time. So there's a number of potential sources, and we believe it. There are problems with odors in Marina. I think of all the agencies involved, we've probably done the most work if no one else, but we just don't have money or resources to continue on that.
Are they still growing greenwood?
Yes, yeah. Yes. They had a digester that was also digesting organic waste, food waste, and that shut down mysteriously. Mm. I don't know why, but we know that's probably proved the smell problem with that. Yeah, retention schedule for records, that's on the board as well, too. Yeah, I already mentioned ribbon cuttings. We've been doing a number of ribbon cuttings December 4th, December 10th. We're getting electric school buses out there. It's really fun. The one thing I'll tell you, which may help you remember electric school buses, is now they can play a chip. They play music when they're going below 15 miles per hour because they're deadly silent. So a number of schools are now playing marching bands, or they record their own marching band and put that on a sound file and play it as the bus. So if you get run over by a marching band, it's probably a school bus. So, and then we're we just acquired a drone to assist with our smoke management program. And this is great. We hope to get a publishable paper out of this. But we're looking, instead of releasing balloons and radio songs, we hope to do vertical profiles of atmospheric temperature and mixing heights using drones. And we can bring them back to Earth. We don't have the potential for loss of the balloons and glitter. And they flight, we can control their flight path so they don't go into oncoming aircraft and stuff like that. So that's a really nice thing to see, sort of cutting edge stuff here at the district. And that's it for now. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, future agenda items? If not, we will adjourn. Thank you.